Inside Florida Politics, powered by Gatehouse Florida. Hello, I'm Sarasota Herald Tribune political editor Zach Anderson, and I'm joined as always by Gatehouse Capitol correspondent John Kennedy. Hey, John.
Hello, Zach.
Well, it's early November, and even in odd-numbered years like 2019, that still means elections in much of the country, including in many municipalities here in Florida. We'll discuss some of the election results in Florida and how they fit in with what happened across the country this week. We'll also talk about a big state Supreme Court hearing on the felon voting rights issue and a new job for former Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi. But first, all know what that music means. It's time for our pick a number segment. John, did you come bearing the gift of a number today?
Zach, my number this week is four, a fab four.
All right, fab four. I can top that. My number is 132. That's a four for John, 132 for me. Write those numbers down, folks. We'll come back to them at the end of the show and tell you what they mean for Florida politics. Well, Florida is used to being the center of attention when it comes to elections, but that was not the case this week. We don't hold big off-year statewide races like in Kentucky, where a Democrat shocked the country by winning the governor's race in a state that President Donald Trump carried by 30 percentage points. We also don't hold off-year elections for the state legislature, like in Virginia, where Democrats seized control of the General Assembly for the first time in a generation. Are you all sensing a pattern here? Democrats had a big night Tuesday, and Florida really wasn't part of that narrative. There weren't any major bellwether races here, but there were a few notable victories. Orlando Mayor Buddy Dyer won a fifth term. He's a prominent Florida Democrat who has run statewide before. Florida Democrats also bragged about flipping some GOP-controlled seats in various city councils, including here in Southwest Florida, where a progressive Democrat won the mayor's race in the city of Venice. For those of you who don't know Venice, it's a small city of about 20,000 along the Gulf Coast, and it's in a very, very Republican area. It has a lot of retirees who are reliable GOP voters. There are 8,975 registered Republicans in Venice and just 5,487 registered Democrats. So at first glance, that looks like a pretty good pickup for Democrats. But when you drill down further, the Democratic candidate only won 40% of the vote. He benefited from two Republican candidates splitting the other 60% of the GOP vote. So I'm not sure Trump has anything to worry about in Southwest Florida. I don't necessarily see that race as a sign that his support is slipping significantly, even though the Florida Democratic Party touted it as one of their big pickups this cycle. There are some encouraging takeaways for Democrats from the Venice mayor's race, though. I mean, a win is a win. A Democratic turnout was 54% compared to 48% turnout for Republicans. That's noteworthy. If we saw Democratic turnout statewide top GOP turnout like that in 2020, it would be very bad news for the GOP. The Democrat also raised $28,000, which is pretty good for a small-town mayor's race. So some signs of Democratic enthusiasm in conservative Venice, Florida. John, I know you were watching the election results from around the country and here in Florida. Overall, it seems like Republicans do have some reasons to be concerned, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, you do wonder if the trends that we've seen in other states are going to come to Florida. Suburban voters, especially women, seem to be trending away from the Republican Party toward Democrats, helping the party's usual urban enclaves of voters, while rural communities seem to still be backing Republicans. When you think of much of Florida, it's a pretty suburban state, and at least much of it from Central Florida south and then around the Jacksonville area. Another thing is that Governor DeSantis basically is the state's leading Republican. You wonder, is he recognizing this coming shift too? He's not on the ballot next year, but he is promoting environmental initiatives and a teacher pay raise. These are not exactly red meat Republican things. So is he looking to help fellow Republicans appeal more to the middle next year? In this state, Republicans have dominated the state House and Senate for years, but you wonder, could Republicans make inroads in some of these suburban-oriented seats? All 120 House seats are up for grabs next year and half of the 40 Senate seats. generally, you know, as everybody recognizes, President Trump has been pretty off-putting for many voters, especially those in the suburbs who might normally default Republican. But for Florida Democrats to catch this wave again, they're going to have to put up the right candidates in these seats and compete. One of the historic problems in Florida is that these district boundaries have been drawn in such a way that each party has a safe share of districts. Republicans, obviously, far more than Democrats, but it discourages either party for competing in some districts. But for Republicans, or I should say for Democrats this go around, there could be a push, especially in suburban Miami districts in a county that is already turning blue, and the suburbs of Orlando, where these bedroom communities are starting to look more like the city that, you know, as you mentioned, easily reelected Buddy Dyer, a former Democratic legislator and unsuccessful statewide office seeker who right now looks able to stay mayor as long as he wants, really, in that city.
Yeah, as you mentioned, a lot of the Democratic victories were propelled by suburban voters, which has been the story really ever since Trump was elected. When you look at the 2018 elections, Democrats picked up congressional seats in suburban areas. Suburban women especially have been turning away from the GOP because of their concerns about Trump. And I just wonder, we've talked about this before. I just wonder if Florida, fits neatly into that narrative. I just feel like the suburbs here are a little bit different than like the suburbs of Philadelphia or Northern Virginia or some of these, big cities that have a lot of high paying jobs. Florida is not known for having a lot of sort of high paying jobs where you have a lot of really wealthy suburban voters. It's just a little bit different here. The suburbs have a lot of retirees who are older and tend to vote Republican. Like even this area where I live, Sarasota and Manatee, when the Democrat Margaret Good announced that she was going to challenge Congressman Vern Buchanan, who's a seven-term incumbent, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee put out a little press release that was noting all the reasons that this district should be in play here and touting Margaret Good's candidacy. And one of the things they said is that this is a suburban district. And I was kind of like, really? I mean, is it really is Sarasota and Manatee County? I mean, for people who don't know the area, they might just take that at face value. We are about an hour, 45-minute drive from Tampa, depending on where you are. So it's kind of a suburb of Tampa in a way, but really it's more of a retirement heavy community. I mean, you have suburban development patterns where it's a lot of single family homes and not a lot of like high rise or urban centers, but it just doesn't strike me as the same as the Philadelphia suburbs or something like that, where you have a lot of young professionals, especially who are higher educated, higher income, and are turning away from the GOP. But we'll see if that trend plays out in Florida. I could see it maybe in South Florida to some degree, maybe around the Orlando and Tampa area, which are obviously huge battlegrounds. But I don't think that trend is going to be as pronounced here personally. All right. Well, there are a lot of different factors that could swing elections in 2020. And one that we'll be watching here in Florida is the potential for a lot of new voters this cycle because of an amendment to the state constitution that restores voting rights for most felons. It is estimated that 1.4 million felons could regain the right to vote because of the amendment, but that number could be significantly less because of an implementing bill passed by the GOP-controlled legislature that requires felons to repay all court-related fines, fees, and restitution before they can vote. That law has been challenged in court, and this week, Governor Ron DeSantis appealed to the state Supreme Court to give an advisory opinion on whether requiring repayment of financial obligations is legal. John was at the court to hear the arguments for and against conditioning voting on paying these costs. John, what stuck out to you about the court hearing?
Yeah, I it's pretty amazing. The 2020 election is soon upon us, but we're still trying to unpack the things that happened in 2018. And this fight over Amendment 4 is one of them. as you mentioned, it all comes down to interpretation of whether completing terms of a sentence means fully paying all fees, fines, and restitution that may have been ordered by a court. Voters groups say it shouldn't. They maintain that making voters contingent on their qualifications, contingent on paying financial obligations, that violates equal protection and due process provisions of the United States Constitution. The amendment that was approved by voters didn't specifically state that these costs would be paid, but it was promised by the Florida Rights Restoration Campaign and was during its campaign. And it was presented that way before justices in 2017 when they reviewed the proposed amendment for the ballot. As we've said many times on this podcast before, the Florida legislature approved this law during the spring that requires payment of all costs before felons are eligible. But the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, was among those challenging the law, and it's now bound for a trial in federal court in April, where a judge has already urged legislators to revisit the law before, you know, early next year. That would be before the trial. And he's called the current setup, his quote was, "It's an administrative nightmare." But for now, DeSantis is looking basically to get support in this legal fight over the law from the 7-member Florida Supreme Court, 3 of whose justices he just appointed in January. And that's where he went this week in seeking this advisory opinion, which he hopes will defend the new state law. You know, it's funny, these 3 new justices are members of the Federalist Society. That's a conservative legal organization committed to what is described as a textual approach to the law, you know, basically respecting the language used and not injecting personal beliefs or politics. But in this case, Justice Barbara Lagoa, among the things that she cited in questioning an attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union, she brought in a voter's guide used by the ACLU to try to make her point about how voters were told that these financial obligations would be part of the deal. Here's what she said as she was questioning the ACLU lawyer.
The ACLU in particular, when you had a voter guide about constitutional amendments, specifically said the ACLU of Florida supports Amendment 4, which would return the eligibility to vote to Floridians who have completed the terms of their sentences, including any probation, parole, fines, or restitution. This is what was told to the voters of Florida.
And then Lagoa went on to read from a Miami Herald editorial. She also, that's not exactly the text of the law, but she was trying to make the case that voters expected that these payments would be made so that presumably the new law is okay. But here's the lawyer from the ACLU. This is Anton Marino saying what's at stake in this case. Marino cited a study that showed 80% of felons have some legal financial obligations, meaning that most of the 1.4 million felons who could be eligible to vote will never have that chance. Here's Marino.
Every person unable to pay is serving a life sentence. It cannot be that more than 4 out of 5 returning citizens is serving a life sentence. And adopting the governor's interpretation leads to an absurd result that contravenes the chief purpose of the amendment.
So but you know, another thing with the elections coming on, there's a lot of political pressure in this case. There are 1.4 million felons who could become eligible, and that could be a real factor leading into the elections, which President Trump is in a mostly must-win Florida situation, and Governor DeSantis is one of his steadiest supporters. If he gets a favorable ruling from the Florida Supreme Court, that may be helpful, but it won't be decisive. This is not a state court matter, but it's in federal court where voters groups say requiring felons to pay before they vote conflicts with the U.S. Constitution. That's the real battleground where that April trial is going to be, is now scheduled. But the long settlement of this matter is really slowing the registration of this vast pool of potential voters. And, you know, whatever comes out of the state Supreme Court, this hearing will be probably going to be somewhat helpful to DeSantis in his argument. But again, this is going to be decided by a federal judge right now.
Yeah, kind of unusual for the governor to try and short circuit this federal case and go to the state Supreme Court and get some kind of ruling that really just, I mean, it won't have any binding effect on the federal case, right? It just sort of is something that he can tout in their legal arguments in this federal case that, oh, the Supreme Court agrees with us.
Yeah, I think that's about it. And, you know, when you think of it, too, one of the things that the federal judge has recommended is that the legislature revisit this issue when they reconvene in January. But I suppose if they get a ruling or an advisory opinion from the Florida Supreme Court that says effectively that the law is okay and it's clear that, right, you know, people are supposed to pay, that would, diminish the motivation for the legislature to do anything. So.
But fundamentally, this is a federal issue, right? This is a constitutional challenge. They're basically saying that this provision violates the U.S. Constitution Equal Protection Clause. The jurisdiction is federal, right?
Yeah, that seems to be pretty decided right now. The governor was trying to get it into state court as a fight, but the federal judge, dismissed that challenge, and it looks like it's bound for federal court. You know, to a great degree, I think for Republican legislators, maybe wary of the potential impact of this vast voting pool that could be registered, any delay is good right now. In that, you know, it just postpones the effort to try to get these felons registered as 2020 nears. So sure. I think, you know, the longer they can drag it out, the better for the party right now.
Well, that many new voters certainly could have a big impact on the 2020 election. And another issue that looms large as 2020 approaches is impeachment. And of course, there are plenty of Florida angles, as always. The latest involves former Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi, who has agreed to join the communications team that is defending the president publicly as the impeachment probe heats up. John, what do you think? Is hiring Bondi a good move for Trump?
Yeah, well, Bondi will be Fox News ready whenever it comes to defending the president as this impeachment inquiry deepens.
Yeah, she even hosted a Fox News program, I think, at least for one episode. So she's definitely
for a brief period, right? She's had a tryout. It's one of those things that right now she's going to be involved in messaging, I guess, seems to be the operative term. She brings the resume of a two-term attorney general in the nation's third largest state, but frankly, she's not a great quick-witted responder. Based on my years of covering her in Tallahassee, she sticks to the talking points, and that's a strong suit for Trump right now.
Well, maybe that's something they need after Rudy Giuliani going off script.
The freestyling approach doesn't seem to be working that well. But Bondi, of course, was an early Trump loyalist, and lately she's been a lobbyist with Ballard Partners, which represents Trump's business interests in Florida, among other clients. And she was the only statewide elected Republican who campaigned with Trump in 2016, and she was seen for a long time as likely getting a big job in the administration, having been rumored as a candidate for attorney general to succeed Jeff Sessions, if you can remember that far back, before he left. That didn't happen. And she also had some controversy with Trump that surfaced largest back in 2016. She had accepted a $25,000 campaign contribution from the Trump Foundation, which he later dissolved amid an investigation. And that $25,000 contribution came shortly after Bondi's office said it might investigate wrongdoing by Trump University's business seminars. Now, once that $25,000 arrived, the investigation disappeared, or the state's involvement in any investigation. And that was seen as a potential quid pro quo long before the Ukrainian government was on the receiving end of the latest allegation of quid pro quo. So, you know, in the end, Bondi is a fan, and she'll be able to talk some on TV. But given her track record, I'd say she can only help the president so much.
Well, she's definitely a loyalist. I mean, I think she was one of the few people in Florida to endorse him before the primary, the end of the primary there. She has been stuck with him, despite some of that controversy over the donation related and her involvement in the Trump University case. She's always defended Trump and been very loyal to him. And we all know the president values loyalty. So she seems like whether or not she can make the case effectively, we'll see. But she certainly seems to fit the mold of what Trump likes in his people. Well, we're going to move on to pick a number. John, you threw out a Fab Four. You want to tell us about that?
I did. Four is the number of public service commissioners who voted against the state's monopoly utility companies this week and rejected a move that would have eliminated the state's 30-year-old energy conservation program. Now, these conservation standards are designed basically to encourage customers to use, energy-efficient light bulbs, install attic installations, generally reduce their electrical usage in Florida, which is the third highest electric-using state in the nation. But these four investor-owned utilities earn money by selling electricity, so conservation really isn't in their interest. And they'd argued that the 30-year-old program is outdated. But consumer advocates and solar groups and others had pushed a letter-writing campaign to commissioners urging that they keep these standards and actually improve on them that they were considering eliminating. The four of the five commissioners that ultimately voted in favor of keeping the program, updating it and coming back with new goals, Florida Power and Light was among the utilities that kind of offered sort of muted thanks to the PSC for its action, which is clearly far from what they wanted. We don't see the governor's fingerprints on this in any way, but given that Governor DeSantis has tried to make something of a mark as a green governor, although so far doing little, but making overtures that he is woke to the idea of climate change, you wonder if the PSC is trying to anticipate what the governor may want. And slashing energy conservation goals would hardly have seemed like a worthy thing in a state where combating sea level rise is always a costly item in many city and county budgets. And this is a small step, but an unusual break for the governor-appointed utility regulators who almost always side with utilities on what they want to do.
That's really interesting, John. I mean, we've talked about the new kind of focus among the state GOP on climate change. It's kind of been baby steps here, talking about resiliency for sea level rise and, doing some things to prepare more for the impacts of climate change than really trying to, reduce climate change by reducing CO2 emissions from power plants. But just this talk, you think, might have been enough to put the PSC on notice that something like energy efficiency is a good thing. And, if you want to get reappointed by the governor, maybe you should think twice about getting rid of it.
Yeah, it's a small step. And I wonder if they're sort of hearing that echo from the governor right now, that the governor wants to at least shine a light on climate change. I think a lot of environmentalists are still wondering just exactly what the governor will do, what he plans to do. And I think as far as how far the legislature would go, that's going to be decided too by the governor and his response to climate change. But he's made a splash by appointing the state's first chief science officer and a chief resiliency officer, and those things seem to suggest that there's more going to be coming out of the governor. So I think anything by the utility regulators to reduce conservation goals would clang into that mission.
Well, it does potentially really show how leadership at the top can really trickle down and affect everybody's attitude and posture towards things like this. So it will be interesting to see if we see more developments like this, where people feel a little bit more empowered because the governor has expressed support for some of these issues. Well, my number is 132. That's how many federal programs rely on census data to distribute funding proportionally to states and local governments. The census data, the population counts that we do every 10 years, helps guide billions in federal spending in Florida and local cities and counties for things like affordable housing, transportation, and healthcare programs. But Florida leaders are concerned that we might not be getting our fair share of that money They point to evidence showing previous census efforts have undercounted Florida's population, depriving the state of billions in federal funding. I was at a press conference this week that was put on by Florida Tax Watch and the city of Sarasota, and they're worried that the 2020 census could again undercount Florida's population and that the state and local governments would receive less funding as a result. And one issue that got some attention during this press conference was the citizenship question that Trump was pushing to include in the census. He was blocked by the Supreme Court from asking about citizenship on the census. But Sarasota City Commissioner Shelley Freeland Eddy said that immigrant groups are still fearful of participating in the census. In addition to losing funding, Florida also could be shortchanged when it comes to new congressional seats if the census count isn't accurate. The state currently has 27 congressional seats and is projected to gain two or maybe three more seats, which is important, you know, to have more representation in Congress. It means that Florida's issues get heard more. But that really all depends on whether everyone is counted. So multiple reasons to keep an eye on how the census unfolds here in Florida. Well, that wraps up another episode of Inside Florida Politics. I want to thank our audio production team of Thomas Cordy and Joseph Rosano. And thanks to all of you for listening. We're out of here.